This is Obrus by Crown Private. Obrus is a membership-based global investor syndicate. My name is James Evenson. I am one of the partners of Crown Private. Joined with me today is Marvin Yee, also one of the partners of Crown Private. We're about three things: people, places, and deals. In this particular podcast, we are going to focus on deals. Marvin Yee, in addition to being a partner in Crown Private, is the managing partner of Crown Financial Services. And I want to interview you today because you have a very keen mind of putting together investment deals. And I'd like to share with our listeners and those who are watching us a bit of what goes on in your mind and your practice of how you construct deals. So, Marvin, first question is, how do you find your deals?
Well, firstly, there is an understanding that the market for money is largely inelastic. So there are always deals around. The key element is getting the right types of deals, the types of deals that are good for our investors. And to that end, we rely a great deal on referrals.
Okay.
Referrals, not just from people in the industry, but also people that we've done work with in the past. Now, this could be other co-investors, or it could also be companies that we have invested in the past. And through their networks, they have in turn referred other opportunities to us.
Okay. Now, we're based in New Zealand. Tell me about, are your referrals, are your connections, are the people you know specifically in this region or throughout the world?
Well, the world's a big place, but certainly this region would be a major part of that, but not just in Australia or New Zealand, which are really quite similar in terms of economy and also legislation, but also from the United States, Asia, and increasingly we're getting quite a few new opportunities in Europe.
Okay.
We have investors from a wide range of areas, not just obviously in Australia and New Zealand, and also Crown is not just based in New Zealand, of course. We're also in Sydney, in Singapore, and Kuala Lumpur.
Okay. So really around the world, our friends and our connections and our network is pretty wide. What kind of results do your deals, the deals that you craft, produce?
Well, ideally, we like to create above market results, of course.
Of course.
So certainly, that's the first area that we look to concentrate on. But to the end, it's also understanding the cyclical nature of certain markets and also the structural nature of that. And ideally, you want to combine the two elements, and that's really how you get into an opportunity that can provide you an above market return. And it's not, say, a general offer to the public whereby the returns may not be that exponential. So, as an example, a lot of companies are good at doing certain things. So whether it's making widgets or whatever service, but they may not understand their industry so much. So having that understanding allows us to understand whether or not this industry is undervalued or it's about to go through a new cyclical change, and the structural element of that allows us to take advantage.
Okay. And are these deals for anyone?
Well, the deals are targeted to wholesale and eligible investors.
Okay.
So legislatively, that's basically the target. Of course, that also covers private equity firms. It covers corporate investors, effectively companies that are in the Financial Markets Conduct Act exemptions.
Gotcha. Perfect. Thank you. I'm thinking about the components of a deal that you put together. And so my context is having traveled extensively with you in the world and having had meetings that have started off with the introductions to a company, and then watching as time goes on, the process that you follow to when you've actually crafted a bespoke deal that is agreed upon by the company that we're investing in. Can you tell us what are some of the components, or what are the key components of for you in crafting a bespoke deal?
Well, firstly, we have to understand what need are we trying to address. And that's normally not just money. Money is needed to do something. So it's not just a matter of providing money to a company. It is a lot better for us to understand what they're trying to achieve with it. This is the difference between raising, say, $1 million and raising $1 billion, because at the end of the day, there are very few constraints to people's hopes and dreams. And of course, the concept of that it takes money to make money is not a unique one. The whole idea is, how do we make lots of money from as little investment as possible? So from that point of view, understanding what the company is trying to achieve is a big part of it. And understanding how we can assist in that manner allows us to be a strategic investor and also play a role post the fundraise. So we are typically not passive investors in this context. So otherwise, you know, you might as well just put your money into a mutual fund. Or
what does it mean to be the opposite of passive would be an active investor? What does that mean to you?
Well, to me, it means that we have a degree of control on the company. Now, on a base level, we would typically look to, depending obviously on the size of capital we bring on, we would typically look for board representation. We would ideally like to be a director of that company. Now, mm-hmm. We may not always want to be a director of that company. There are circumstances where being a director of the company puts us at odds with the interests of investors. So it really comes down to what we're trying to achieve. So if we are looking to be in for a short amount of time and then look to exit quite quickly, then we probably don't want to be a director of the company. But if we are looking at something more strategic, then we probably ought to be there and be able to steer the ship in the direction in which we would have no doubt stated to them in our offer documents to what we are wanting to accomplish.
Okay.
So that will be a key component of that. And depending on the levels of investment, occasionally we may ask, a condition of the investment may be that we end up doing the accounts for the company. We may end up taking on that role. We would have double signatories in terms of certain investments that we, in terms of signing rights on mm-hmm. the accounts. So, obviously, it comes down to the stake that we have in the company. That's probably something we'll ask if we own over 50% of the company, or close to 50% of the company, and probably not something they wouldn't ask if we own 5% of the company. Mm-hmm. But either way, the intention is to ensure that we can exact some strategic value in that, either through the networks we have, or through the operations of Crown itself. You know, be it in transactions, in banking, remittance, and so forth.
All right. Tell us more about the type of companies that you go that appeal to you.
Well, we look for
not necessarily industry, but what are the characteristics that are most common check marks for you?
Well, an appreciation of other people's capital is very important. So consequently, a degree of maturity from the founders. Or the directors, the people who are running the company, it's easier to probably explain what is a bad deal. A bad deal is a bad company, or a company that we wouldn't necessarily want to invest in, is a company where the investors, the key people, have very little stake in the company, and perhaps we're in a second phase of the company where the primary shareholders have already exited out. And effectively, we have a management of a company which, you know, has very little stake in it. And the problem in companies like that, in effect, is that it's a bureaucracy basically creates itself. It's not a great deal dissimilar from government, really. Mm-hmm. The more bureaucracy you have, there's always a reason to have a position. There's always things that need to get done. So the idea is to ensure that we have the right type of people that understands the kind of landscape that they're operating in. And more often than not, because we are looking for companies with exponential growth, we need to look at people that are doers rather than planners. Planning is important. Fail to plan to fail. Having said that, it is important that they have the operational expertise to be able to do it themselves, to be able to roll up the sleeves and do it themselves, which may not necessarily occur in certain companies where the management are detached from shareholders. And there's a tendency, and I've seen a number of occasions, where the tendency is that shareholders are a continuous source or investors are a continuous source of money. And of course, we know that from experience that is a finite commodity. And at some point, the music is going to stop playing and there aren't going to be enough chairs.
Yeah. Marvin, I can't count the number of boards that you have been on of public as well as private companies. So I'm thinking about your past experience of 20-some years in this business. Do you have a checklist in mind when you're thinking about companies, or are there just different? Tell me how you approach it.
Well, certainly we'll look into things. Firstly, as I mentioned earlier, the exponentiality of the opportunity. Mm-hmm. So why invest in this company? Understand the risk premium. So if the company is trying to achieve a certain thing, when we are investing, what state is the company at and how strategic can our capital be employed? So that's probably the first area to look at, to see whether we can strategically turn this company into what it's meant to be. Because at the end of the day, it's good having, it is one thing to have confidence in other people being able to achieve certain results. You can have complete confidence in yourself if you've done things before. And I'm not suggesting we take over the companies, but if we understand what they're trying to achieve, then we know that that's something that we can be, assist in. And in those cases, we have 100% certainty upon achieving certain results. So for example, if the company requires needs to be licensed in a particular area, that's an area we know we have some expertise in. We know I would say at least 99% certainty that we can accomplish that. And if that means that it has a greater valuation, then that is going to be a good thing for our investors. So this is different from just relying on somebody else, wanting to achieve those results. So that's one element of it. Having said that, having the company with passion for what they're doing is very important. Looking at employees that are not solely motivated by money, because at the end of the day, most of the companies that we're backing to achieve this exponential return are effectively companies who are trying to disrupt the industry, or they're the underdog. For the most part, I think that would be a good example. If they're the underdog, they're not the dominant player, at least not yet. So consequently, if you have employees that are only looking a high remuneration, you're never going to be able to compete on that, because there'll always be a larger company and they can do that. So strategically, you need to balance. You need to balance those out. You need to ensure that the people, that the staff and the management, particularly, are adequately motivated to ensure that the goals of the shareholders and investors, both two and the same really, are going to be congruent with what the management is trying to achieve.
Those really are fundamental to private equity investing. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Something I've watched really with great enjoyment is how you can start with a company in terms of the terms that they're looking for when they approach us or when we approach them. And oftentimes I will know your starting point, and you consistently reach agreeable terms that are not where the company started. How do you actually achieve that?
Well, I go back to my earlier point, understanding strategically what they want. companies will come to you with a plan, typically that requires you they would like an investor to have a passive stay in the business. Many companies will want a strategic investor, but many companies don't necessarily understand what that means, and we have to decipher that language, because especially early stage companies, you can conversely ask, well, would you like an unstrategic investor? So it's almost like saying, I want a good person on the board. I said, well, yeah, as opposed to what, a bad person? So so understanding what they're trying to achieve. So most companies, what they really mean is that they just want the cash. They want the cash. They have the vision to execute in a particular way. It's usually a BHAG, big, hairy, audacious goal. And we want to support that, because you don't get exponential returns by not going after BHAGs. So in order to do so, by understanding how we can strategically assist in that area, that's really when we provide them a solution that goes along with the funding. So we say, well, you may be asking for, let's give an example, $100,000 for 10%. However, we know that with our involvement, we can basically achieve what you want to achieve in, say, a third of the time, through our resources and know-how and so forth. But for that, we will only invest at a valuation of, say, 500. So we want 20% as an example. And we also want a board seat, because in order for us to assist you to reach these goals, we need to have a degree of influence. So that's an example where we are actively involved, and I guess from a rationalization standpoint, we are involved in the creation of that wealth. Companies typically come to you reasonably fully priced. They come to you with the potential, and you're investing in that potential. In this circumstance, we are actually part of that potential. We are the part of creating that potential. That's why we can have a much larger negotiating position.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Next thought on my mind is Crown Private has a rather diverse portfolio, ranging from startup to more established deals. You just described the conditions of the types of what you consider a good company. And I'd like to understand how startups fit into that. How do you choose startups? Because there are a lot more variables, vagaries in an early stage company than in an established company with a mature and established structure. So how do you find decent startups? Or good startups?
Well, the first thing to look for is to ensure that there is an opportunity there. Now, I'm not with a startup. The exponential forecast is probably not that relevant, because if you're starting from zero, anything is going to be better than that. And arguably every result is going to be exponential. So I would look at the risk premium. Look at firstly to see whether it could work. You clearly need to create a distinction between an investment strategy, and it has to create and to be distinct from that of a gambling strategy. So the concept of spray and pray, it's not one that I exactly. It's not one that I subscribe to. I use in many respects, I use an analogy of a roulette table. I'm not really a gambler, but I understand the mechanics of how it works. And it really comes down to a matter of, say, well, am I going to get more than for this type of risk, am I going to get more returns than I would necessarily get in the table? So on a roulette table, you got 36 to 1 is the payout. That's my understanding. I could be wrong, but that's my understanding. barring a few, it's probably a bit less than 36 with a few other pieces on the board. But the key element really is that, am I going to get such an exponential for the amount of money I'm putting in, or should I just bet it all on black? Then if I bet on black, I have a 50% chance of winning by and large. So that's really the kind of understanding on the exponentiality of the opportunity. So we all need to have a basis of that. So now I look at it from that point of view first and say, well, okay, if that company passes that and it is going to be there is an exponential potential, then the next question, having established that, is to say, well, now I want to be part of the deal, but how do I get the best value on this? And that's really where we see how we can assist them to achieve that. And understanding, of course, that with startup companies, there is a distinct premium that needs to be placed on the risk. And the earlier that you're involved in the company, the more binary that investment is, the higher the premium needs to be. So it is not a system that is not designed to be easy. It is certainly designed to ensure that there is an appreciation both by the company as well as the investor that of the premium associated with the risk capital, at least to start things off. So
you're on, we've already discussed you're on a number of boards, and I know that you're on early stage boards as well. With your experience in private equity, how do you apply that to your board involvement in a startup?
Well, a board in a startup is a lot more advisory based compared to a board in a more established company, which is arguably more governance based. So there needs to be an appreciation of the two elements. Advisory, typically, if there are younger founders involved, typically where we have a more active role in the company, but also understanding that for the company to grow beyond a startup, then it requires some reasonably significant understanding of the governance requirements for that. And that is really where, when I look at a board role, that is one of the elements of being able to transform that company from a startup mentality to one that is more mature without necessarily compromising on the enthusiasm that is requisite for a startup, for the company to succeed. So that's really the balance of the two. And the reality of the matter is that we don't really invest in very early stage companies. So I'm thinking about pre-seed, seed. Very, very rarely, we wouldn't be investing in the back of a napkin, for example. So the reality of the matter is that, but the ideal situation for in terms of the lifespan of a company would be where we can add some value in transitioning them for what may be a family run, one to five, it's a less than 10 man company, we should be involved in the transition of that, say, 10 man company to a 50 man company. So that's, and we provide and one of the things we add as a board, is to look to turning that company into a capacity where they have both the retaining the enthusiasm, but also being able to have the governance, the structures in place to basically create that ramp for exponential growth.
Well, I appreciate that because I think firsthand of companies that we have invested in when they're early stage, and then when we're presented with an opportunity to participate in another round. We're not doing so blindly. We're not doing so like a typical newcomer investor. We actually have someone like yourself who is on the board, who has overseen the development of that company, so that if we're participating in yet another round of investment, we have confidence that with that company and with the people that are running that company. And essentially, we're also very active in the running of that company. Very, very, very helpful. I think at this point, I'd like to just briefly summarize that our focus has been on Marvin and how you bring us to deals, how you structure deals. And granted, it's not just you, but our focus of this particular podcast is on you. really clearly, not to overflatter you, but a significant, you have significant capabilities that you demonstrate in crafting the bespoke deals that we produce for our members. So thank you for that. I would like to highlight just two more things. One is, I'd like you to speak just a bit about Crown Financial Services. So Crown Private is in partnership with Crown Financial Services, sharing the same crown. Can you speak to that a bit? What is Crown Financial Services and what does it bring to us?
Sure. Well, so Crown Private is a subsidiary of Crown Financial Services. And Crown Financial Services is a regulated entity. It is, investment business is regulated by the Financial Markets Authority. Our transactions business is regulated by the Department of Internal Affairs. And our depository business is regulated by the Reserve Bank of New Zealand. What the benefits translate to is that Crown Private is able to benefit from the hereditary nature of some of these licenses. Mm-hmm. And in our case, particularly those in dealing with investors, and also being able to refer on other types of opportunities, say to other areas of the business, like transactions and so forth, whereby these are particularly helpful for, say, portfolio companies that we invest in. So if a company, they may have difficulties in having banking facilities, for an example, and we may invest in them, but and as part of that that combination, we may be able to, as part of the proposition, we may be able to assist them in having, say, lines of credit, some transactional accounts, and so forth, obviously depending on the type of business. So it becomes, it expands a much wider proposition than just providing a company with growth capital or investment. So
sure.
So that's effectively okay. the relationship. And also we know that, you know, the investors can have confidence with that, you know, the types of deals that we present to them are ones that are not without recourse, ones that are well vetted. They are ones that take into account the risk premium and obviously the exponentiality of the investment, without compromising its quality.
Absolutely. You know what? I do want to focus on one phrase because it's come up several times: risk premium. Just define that in your own terms, because that is
sure.
clearly a focus of what we.
Oh, absolutely. A risk premium is the same. It's effectively a situation where if you're going to be investing in an earlier stage company, things are naturally going to be more risky than perhaps if you were investing in IBM. So where a company, where an established company would, where with a very low risk premium, and you can substitute, it's not IBM, it could be AT&T, it could be whatever, then you may find that the variation of the returns you get, and, you know, government treasury bills are a good example, the returns are not exactly great. People are not going to rely on this a great deal for them to create wealth. It's more of a method of storing wealth. And we need to have those types of things as well. But it's not quite the focus of what Crown is
Absolutely.
Involved in, particularly Crown Private. Therefore, the risk premium is simply taking into account the risky nature of earlier growth stage companies and ensuring that we're adequately recognized for that. And when I say recognized, it means, you know, we are given a much better return to appreciate that. It's not the old saying, you know, high risk, high gain, low risk, low gain. Though for our point of view, what we're trying to do is to minimize the risk while still retaining as much of the upside as possible. And that does take into account ensuring that the degree of risk is understood. And not so much just from a capital preservation standpoint, but in terms of the premium that will be attached to our investor dollars for taking the company, for believing in the company, perhaps at the time when they most need it.
Mm, great, great. You know, that actually reminds me of another question that a lot of the deals that we participate in are not an equity position, but actually structured debt. Can you speak a bit about what you're looking for there, and what is the return, but how is that valuable to our sure. investors to be involved with a structured debt?
Well, in some respects, a lot of the structured debt elements have come out from an understanding that many early stage equity investments, in fact, I would say the majority of early stage equity investments are very binary. The idea of a structured debt product is to ensure that we can hold the company to a degree of accountability to what they're telling us. So it is it provides, unlike say an equity investment where it may take some time for us to raise a round bring on investors to be interested in it. Most structured debt investments, we can commit to it. Largely utilizing our own resources, we can underwrite the deal in most instances. And therefore, effectively what the company is trading on, therefore, is they are really paying us a premium for us providing them certainty. So we give them so they understand that there's a degree of certainty that we provide, and that's going. But the price of that largely is us saying to the company, well, you have to do what you say you're going to do, and this is not just a best effort basis. You need to do so. You're legally obliged to do so, and typically we have warranties and so forth. And we have registered securities against assets of the company to ensure that those things occur. We don't provide debt facilities to everyone. Obviously, having a debt facility in a startup is not particularly helpful.
Correct.
Not unless the person's prepared to mortgage his house. The reality of and
we wouldn't go after that anyway.
Well, no. You would. If a person was prepared to mortgage his house, they would go to a bank rather than
correct
and get a much lower interest rate than perhaps they would get from us. So there is that. So certainly the debt products typically are much higher yielding. That's really I guess if we look at the greater Crown Group, debt is a big part of our offering. We tend to look at much higher return. Mm-hmm. We have being Crown Financial Services originated in the financing of started off in the financing of equipment really, but it is ineffectively licensed as a finance company. Mm-hmm. So that is the nature of the business of our core business. So doing finance is something that we are well familiar with. And what we are doing is in cases of the structured debt is providing a almost a bank type facility in an industry where it is typically not a lot of security. There's not a lot of debt funding available in those areas outside, an owner having to mortgage their house. So we come in that in between spot and are able to basically reduce significantly, really, the risk premium. Mm-hmm. In that respect, particularly if we're looking at securitized debt. But also that enhances our ability to influence companies as well. So, a number of the investments we made in the past, even through debt deals, have resulted in us having some degree of influence on the board. And some of those have translated to additional investment, which comes with additional board seats. And it is by understanding the different nature of the company that we can best assist them in that. So it is not uncommon for us to bring on an industry expert that could assist in the board, for example, because at the end of the day, our priority is twofold. We want the company to succeed. That's first and foremost. Effectively, many of these debt facilities are the equivalent of us speaking softly, but carrying a a big bet.
A lot of crossover with private equity. Significant crossover there.
It is a hybrid, isn't it? And I guess that's the difference. That's part of the unique nature of which, you know, if we were just purely providing debt, you know, we would be dissimilar from a bank or a regular finance company.
Correct. It really is strategic finance where it's a, the goal is that it's a win-win for both parties. Ultimately, we want our shareholders, our investors to benefit from
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. Our shareholders needs to benefit from the congruence. And what we're trying to create here is the congruence between forecasts and actuals.
Right. I'd like to speak to one. I'm not going to go into the specifics of the name of the company, but a deal that that you put together recently. I certainly appreciated the balance of the security that you brought with the risk of investment. That it's, though it is a high yielding outcome, the risk for it is quite low. And that is you, Marvin, putting together that deal and structuring it in a way that the company gets what it needs, our investors get the return that is warranted, and the risk for them is extremely low.
Yes, yeah, certainly that is the intention. It does take some time to put those deals together. Of course, I think the deal you're referring to particularly, that had to go through three different regulatory bodies for approval. And we were in a unique situation of being able to capitalize on the fact that it was only open to a select type of investor. We were able to use that and also utilize another aspect of a different part of the regulation they had to go through for us to be able to exit the investment. And that meant that we basically had a reasonable premium with very low risk. So the transaction was guaranteed because effectively, in order for this group to gain a significant control, they needed someone like ourselves to basically create the structure that allows us to both come in and go out reasonably easily.
Excellent. Well, I think we're going to wrap up in just a moment, but I do have one more question for you. We in Crown could be based anywhere on the planet. Well, why New Zealand?
Well, New Zealand's a very unique location. Firstly, it is it has been number one on the Transparency Perception Index for at least the last 3 years, and it's only gone up on the index. So
how can you be number one and keep going up?
Well, it's based out of 100, so we just keep accumulating more and more points. I think we went from 73 to 85 or something to that effect just in the past year. So from a structural standpoint, it is a good location to provide confidence to other regulators that this is a clean structure. It is not located in a tax haven. It is a structure which has a degree of confidence internationally. So that's one. And because when people think of New Zealand, for the most part, if there was a view on our political view on most matters, most people would agree that New Zealand's quite neutral on most things. So consequently, it is not involved, and arguably may not necessarily matter to a great deal, you know, where it comes in on the political spectrum. But that neutrality is, at least in the mind of regulators and also investors, I think helps us in that process. But more accurately, though, we have that reputation, but the type of structure we use for investments are particularly tax friendly. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we make use of legally, of course, we have pass-through entities that are approved by the IRD, Inland Revenue Department, for particular kinds of investments to ensure that they are exempt from at least New Zealand taxation anyway. And that allows a very robust structure particularly in regards to how capital gains tax is calculated, which for most investors, that would be the primary means on which they would be gaining the income from these investments. So that's we have other structures that are not just based in New Zealand, we have structures based out in Singapore. That is a reasonably good structure in regards to income tax. So when we would say horses for courses, there are different structures to suit. So we're not exclusively based in New Zealand. We're certainly not all our structures are based in New Zealand. But particularly, and I guess we see this a lot more with our current members, particularly the ones from the US and so forth, the nature of taxation of these investments in New Zealand and the nature of taxation that goes along with our structures is one that's particularly more friendly, more optimized than they may otherwise be used to. And therefore, that also changes the risk dynamics in terms of the investment.
All right. Well, Marvin, thank you very much for your time, and thank you for leading us on the deal front in Crown Private.